I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, folks, welcome. Mike Alameco here. Great show today. Welcome to Food Talk this Thursday, or whatever day it is you listen to these podcasts. But anyway, welcome, welcome, welcome. It's cold in New York. It's February. That's normal. We've got a great show today. It's going to be a fast-paced show. We're playing with all kinds of formats this half of the third season. We had Ryan Sutton, one guest, 1 hour a couple of weeks ago, and that was a blast. But this week's going to be a faster clip. I've got three great guests coming at you in the next hour. My first guest is Stanton Barrett, and we're going to talk about CBD delivery methods. If you don't know what that is, stay tuned. And he's also just this epically cool guy. He's a stunt guy. He's been in like 100 and some movies, and now he's in Colorado playing around with edible marijuana, but not to get high, to make you, well, we'll explain what it is in a minute. After him, I've got Alice Loubaton, who has been in the cheese and wine space her whole life. And, you know, we talked about cheese and wine last week, and then we talked about cheese and wine the week before. Love that topic. We had cheese producers out here, so we're going to talk about Cheese Week in New York next week. And last is Ian Perkayashatha. I can't even pronounce his name. He's going to pronounce his name for you. The kid's like 23 years old. He's got a huge import business. He has a book out called... Hold on. I have the book with me. Called... Drumroll... Truffle Boy. Because that's what he does. He sells truffles and other things. He's smart as shit. So anyway, a quick recap of the week. A big shout out to my boys at Kuma Inn. I got a text. I came to New York on Tuesday morning this week, and I got a text Tuesday afternoon from my buddy Brandon Webb. You know him, former SEAL Team 3 guy. He was the lead sniper instructor for all of the SEALs. He's a badass. Been deployed a bunch. He's a best-selling New York Times author and a digital media guy, runs SoftRep and a bunch of other things. So when your Navy SEAL buddy texts you and says, hey, man, let's do dinner tonight. I got some friends I want you to meet. You're kind of like, really? I guess I will. But I said, dude, it's fucking Valentine's Day. Like, Valentine's Day. Like, who goes out on Valentine's Day? It's like the worst day of the year if you're a restaurant guy. Because, I mean, sorry for everybody that went out on Valentine's Day. I don't want to make you feel bad. But, like, if you're in the restaurant business, it sucks. Because it's a night of deuces, first of all, which is like the... Twos. That's all you're picking up is deuces. No four tops, no six tops, no eight tops. It's all deuces. And then it's like, I don't know, it's like cheesy. It's like heart-shaped pink desserts and stuff. I don't know. And I'm like, how am I going to get a table? It's fucking Valentine's Day. But I got us in someplace. And who shows up but his buddy, Clint Emerson, who I'd never met before, but I'd heard about, former SEAL Team 6. If you don't know what SEAL Team 6 is, Google them. They are the baddest motherfuckers on planet Earth. The guy's a nut. 20-year SEAL. He's retired now. You know, I boxed. I've got a couple of black belts. I do open water swims, swam around Key West. You name it. I've done all kinds of shit, so I consider myself kind of like my own mini action hero. You meet these guys, you aren't shit. SEAL Team 6. We had a blast. We went to Kuma Inn, ate, and then we went out to some bars and drank too much. He's also the author of 100 Deadly Skills, which is a really funny book. And then last night was a great wine tasting at Rouge Tomat. Pascaline arranged it, as well as, who's the importer? Jenny and Francois. Damien was in. He's a Loire Valley producer. He's doing great stuff with Chenin Blanc, with Cab Franc, and with Cote, also known as Malbec. It was so much fun. Love Pascaline. She's a master somm. There's only 122 of those and 22 women who've been able to do that. So far, it's been a great week. Tonight I'm getting pizza at Roberta's, so it's gonna be a good night tonight too. Anyway, let me introduce you to my next guest, Stanton
Barrett of Ojai Energetics. By way of background, he is, I mean, this guy is like, talk about action hero shit. A stock car driver. He's raced all over in all kinds of stock car stuff. I mean, Talladega? Yeah, Talladega. Talladega. I mean, holy shit. But as if that wasn't enough, I mean, I want to add, like, you have so many careers. So he's a stock car driver, but he's also a stuntman that's been in 200 films. His dad was a stuntman. Paul Newman is your godfather?
Yes, that's correct.
That's so cool. So just before we get to Ojai Energetics, I guess so your dad was a stunt guy, and that's what led you to, like, the same kind of career path? I mean...
Yeah, basically, yeah. Thanks for having me on the show, too. Yeah, he was a stuntman, director, stunt coordinator, and kind of grew up around the business. But I grew up around a very athletic family. My mom was a World Cup skier, Olympic skier. My grandpa coached the U.S. ski team. She was the youngest woman to win a World Cup medal until the Vancouver Olympics. So I grew up around this crazy athletic family. She's done 4 Ironman triathlons.
The full Ironman. That's two, that's
two
insane.
Two in Hawaii, 2 in Invitational Japan. Finished 2nd in her class in Japan. She's quite
beast.
Quite an animal.
Beast. She's a beast.
So when you go out with your mom and she's 70 and can hang on a mountain bike pretty well, usually.
That's
great. Grew up with some tough genetics.
That's so freaking cool.
So we got into stunts kind of on accident, I guess. My brother and I were racing motocross from a young age on a factory KTM team and raced professional and ski raced, you know, at high levels and mountain bike, everything. So when movies went from more Western and car to more extreme sports, my dad's like, well, I might as well hire my 2 kids because they can do 6 professional sports and I don't have to hire 20 stunt guys. So I'll try to get rid of these kids sooner than later. No, but so that's kind of how we got into it.
And crazy stuff. I mean, I was reading some of the stuff, like there was, I don't know what magazine or where it was, but there was one stunt where you're on a motorcycle on a rooftop and you had to like land on one roof and then another roof and you're dragging the camera behind you. And like, and ideally these things work when everything works, but suddenly the camera is unattached and shit goes south. And
yeah,
what?
that was the funnest day. But yeah, you're dealt with a lot of different crazy scenarios. Yeah, I was jumping buildings in downtown L.A. Had a big they call it a Vista Vision camera. It's about a 100-pound camera package on a motorcycle, jumping from one building top to another. And then thankfully it didn't break on the transition of a big gap. It broke from one top down to another about 20 feet and the camera broke off and pulled me off the bike, so I had a battery pack on my back, broke 11 bones in my foot. And
and that's your left foot, which is the foot that you need for your clutch.
That's the brake foot and clutch. Yeah,
I mean, not that you don't need both feet everything. But yeah, and then like, so, and you broke, like, how many bones? Like, this, 100?
About 72, I guess.
But, and big ones, like
femurs, legs, ribs.
God damn, how old are you?
Collarbones. 44.
Brother, you look great. 44 years old, stuntman. So tell me about, so, you know, 420 is coming up, so I'm being, like, deluged with 420 ideas from this whole community. And I've had people on here that are, you know, this, the whole, you're not in that space, but the whole legalization of edibles is kind of expanding. The last election it expanded. I know people, and there's certainly an underground in New York of edibles that has percolated up. Everybody knows about it. You're based in Colorado?
No, we're actually based in Ojai, California.
You're going to California. Yep. Ojai, which makes sense, the name of the brand.
Yeah.
So tell me about CBD. What is it? Because, I mean, I don't want to – you're the expert, what it does, and how is it extracted, and how – so this is – this is – you talk. I'm going to shut up.
So, well, in back, you know, you mentioned Navy SEALs, too. I directed a film called Navy SEALs versus Zombies, and there was
that.
A couple Navy SEALs in there, Kevin Kent and Mikel Vega, who great guys. So I've got to hang out with some SEAL dudes that are pretty
like,
cool.
They're like larger than life, aren't they?
They kind of fit in with our stunt crew a little bit. They're kind of same mentality. But the cannabinoids, though, with relationship to the difference of marijuana, which is a THC, is psychoactive cannabinoid. And we deal with CBD, which is another cannabinoid derived from hemp. And we extract that from an industrial hemp that has low THC. Our product and is legal in all 50 states and about 35 countries because THC is under your federal legal limits. And how we take and where we purchase the hemp extract from falls under the Farm Bill, so it allows us to sell it legally as well.
So, in other words, this is all legit.
So this is all legit. And right. As far as a CBD cannabinoid, it's a phytonutrient that it's a supplement, basically, that your body needs. You have your own endocannabinoid system, and CBD works with your endocannabinoid system, and your CBD1 and CBD2 receptors works with your neuroreceptors as well, and gets the – it's kind of like the – your body's the engine, and it's the fuel to – prime your body and get it working.
Talk about some of the effects, because it's really interesting. It's kind of had this broad application from helping people trying to quit drugs or quit alcohol to mood swings or depression. What does it do? How's it working in the brain? What's it tinkering with?
Primarily, the best way to look it up is look up and just search online the endocannabinoid system, and you can look under that and see what your endocannabinoid system supports. It supports all those things that you're talking about. So it's really a reflective element to supporting your cardiovascular, your brain function, your kidneys, your mood, your different hormone levels. It's pretty fascinating when you start research. I give people the task, like, just look up the endocannabinoid system, read about it, understand all the systems that supports in your body, and generally most things that humans deal with is a deficiency in their cannabinoid system. And when you take CBD, you just prime it and you fill your body back up with the nutrients it needs so your endocannabinoid system can work. And then you'll understand how many things that is really influential on supporting in your system. It's
when did you start the business?
Will Clyden, our founder, he started it in 2014.
So pretty damn new.
Yeah, it's pretty new. I was very foresight with relationship to innovation and getting patents in the space. We have a lot of different patents in the space, but the most important one is how we deliver the cannabinoids into your system.
How do you?
We brought you the coconut oil,
okay.
And then we have the elixir drops, which
I've seen that in your when you go to the website.
Yep. Basically, we encapsulate ours in a complete water molecule using an organic process. So we're the only one that is actually a hydrosome encapsulated, fully encapsulated in water, and we do that organically. Anybody else that we know and see on the market has a liposome and a hydrosome, your body absorbs much more effectively on an oil. You know, an oil-based product doesn't get absorbed by your body very efficiently. So if you can do that in a hydrosome, that's what your body soaks up the most. A liposome, for example, ours will get into your bloodstream in 30 seconds. A liposome will take 10 minutes. A non-liposome or hydrosome will take 30 minutes. So in 30 seconds,
right.
You
Bingo.
Maintain a lot more nutrition.
So I've got a jar of coconut oil. What am I going to do with this? Is there like a daily dose suggestion?
So
tell me how it works.
The coconut oil, people like to bathe in it.
Okay.
Use a bath. You have the coconut oil and the CBD together.
So then it's soluble through your skin and your bloodstream.
Yeah. Our elixir as well. We're coming out with a great sports gel and cream. That's topical, again, because it's hydrosome. It gets into your system right away. Goes into your skin, goes into your cells. It goes into a cellular level. That's why it's so effective. But the coconut oil, people just like I said, bathe in. They put it on their skin. They like to cook with it. You know, we have some recipes that you can alter, you know, anything with coconut oil or oil. You can utilize the one with the CBD, and you just get extra benefit that the CBD provides. Or you can use our elixir and use it in cooking as well. You know, we do have a lot of people that are putting our elixir into drinks and their cocktails. It's really effective in supporting your liver and kidneys and detoxing and your brain function. Your church and state, they do cocktail with their cocktails in Los Angeles. Chef Tony started Spring Restaurant in Los Angeles. So they have a lunch menu that has our CBD infused within the food, and the cool benefit is food has nutrients and terpenes that work with the CBD. So you can really target, like, oh, I need energy today, I need some focus. So he's kind of created a menu utilizing the nutritional benefits of the food, combining with the supplemental benefits of the CBD.
Gotcha.
And they work together.
Gotcha. Where would be, because we have, this is kind of a New York-based show, but the audience is national, if not international. In the United States, you're in all 50 states distribution-wise?
Yeah, we sell all 50 states.
Through retail brick and mortar or through your website?
Both. We do brick and mortar and website. We've kind of held off on the wholesale and brick and mortar stuff for a while because we restructured the company and rebranded and got it ready to grow like it was growing.
Right, because you're only 2 years old.
Yeah, we're 2 years old. So
well, three, technically.
And it's a huge space, and we have the most influential technology in the space when it relates to cannabinoid delivery. So we started to grow really rapidly and needed to take a step back and fix all that, and now we're ready to go. So we've been really focusing on retail distribution.
Yeah, great problem to have is to grow too fast and then say, hold everything, put the brakes on. Let's gear this up correctly.
Yeah, we had to gear it up correctly so we could grow without any growing pains. You always have growing pains, but without ones that are significantly damaging. So, yeah, you can get it online and at ohaienergetics.com.
OJAIenergetics.com.
You got it.
And we'll have this on the website, too. Would you be in any brick-and-mortar in New York that I know of? Or
we're not right now, but I would say in the next 2 months you'll find us in a lot of different places in New York. Yep.
Because, I mean, you could – trying to think. I don't do too much money. Like, you could be like right up Whole Foods alley. You're organic. You're natural. Yeah. You're a supplement. I mean, they have that whole section of store that I don't go much into, but it's just full of, like, that stuff.
Yeah, we're doing really well in health food stores, organic stores. There's Air One in Los Angeles where they're best-selling CBD, and we're going to expand out into bigger stores. You have to do that in the right way so people know the brand, so when you're on the shelf, it actually moves. So, you know, there's a process to putting it into bigger retail outlets and working your way up so the consumer knows what they're buying
and
just doesn't sit there. So
correct. It's
that's
a
process.
Pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. So that's our process right now.
And how did you get involved?
So I got involved. I met the founder actually on an airplane. We were going skiing. I grew up in Mammoth, and you know, I come from a marketing background. I have a commercial production company, and
I
direct movies and second unit direct and. So I come from a creative side plus being in racing. I've helped a lot of brands grow tremendously with sales and marketing and retail sales, and I've had some other companies. So I understand retail space and consumer business and B2B business and how you market a product, how you get it out to consumers and the process of it all and dealing with like big box stores and small time stores. So I have a lot of experience with growing and branding companies and just came friends with Will Clyden, our founder, and you know, I could see he needed some help. I'm like, well, I'll help you out. And then it turned out like, we need to really take this to the level it should be. And we just got along great. And we both, you know, I do a lot of charity work. And I figured this was a place, you know, I could never make enough money to fix all the problems. But I felt like this was a cause that I could really contribute my time to. That would be really beneficial to help people because that's our goal is to help people live better and have better quality of life and educate them on something that a lot of people don't understand. And we want to just, you know, improve people's lives and health.
And you're a daily user. So how do you use it in what form? Like a supplement? How?
You just take it, you know, in your mouth.
Orally. Boom. Done.
Orally. Yeah. You take however many drops. Ours is unique too because when you take it, it gets into your system so quickly and your cannabinoid receptors take it in and tells you when it's the right dose because ours goes in so quickly and absorbs it that fast. It gets sweet like honey when you have the right dose. So it was like, how do you take it? How many drops? It's like, well, generally you kind of know just based on, you know, people's quality of life and health and how they eat. But the right dosage for ours tells you naturally.
Got you. Your system like it sets like a balance. It sets itself.
So it'll be bitter. You take another half drop, bitter, another half drop maybe, and then it gets a little sweet. And then
Bingo.
You take another half drop, and then it gets like somebody gave you a spoonful of honey. So it's funny to see the transition and the effectiveness of how quickly your body can tell that it's in your system and what it does.
Ojai Energetics, ojienergetics.com. I mean, it's funny because, again, talk about Brandon, I know, because we have mutual friends. We were all both members. I've been a New York Athletic Club member for 27 years now, and Brandon just joined. He lives on the West Coast here, Puerto Rico. I don't know. He's got a place in Tahoe. He's done really well in it with his business.
He's doing good.
Yeah, but he's talked about, you know, when we're done our nasty workouts, we'll go into the steam room and talk trash. And one of the days just came up, he was talking about how, specifically the SEAL Team 6 guys, but how he's in that space of, like, looking for these, like, edge up, for, because SEALs train so hard, and I'm an old fart, and I train my ass off, and you're always kind of injured and coming back in recovery, but how... this, it's like standard orthodoxy that SEALs, particularly in SEALs Team 6 guys, are constantly taking these crazy barrage of supplements because they need that to recover from the workouts and from the constant injuries that you get. I mean, a guy like you that's doing stunts and racing, it's, you must feel that difference.
Yeah, it's been really helpful in my life and quality of life. I can't talk a lot about on the radio what the benefits are because of the FDA stances, but... it's definitely improved my quality of life significantly, and it's a great product. Like I said, it has no psychoactive effect. It gets you into flow state. So somebody like a SEAL that is training or a sniper, they see great results in focus and flow state, and a lot of people know what flow state is.
Yeah.
Like when you're boxing, you're in a zone.
Yep.
It helps you get into flow state. It's really effective in recovery. As well,
you know, definitely. I could use it today. We did 45 minutes of cardio yesterday, and then went to the other side of the gym. We did an hour and 20 minutes of high impact lifting, no breaks. And I went to the pool today to, so I actually took an aspirin, which I, after the workout yesterday, I took a fucking aspirin, which is the first time in my life I've probably done that since, like, I'm post marathon. And I went to the pool today to swim, and it just hurt. I did like a mile and a quarter, and I just, fuck, I was by myself, and I'm like, everything hurt. My high hamstrings, my shoulders, my back, my all the things that we were doing, because we did a full legs and upper body and back and chest, and so this tonight's going to get used.
Yeah, you should take a soak and a bath in that, and you'll love our sports gel. When we get that out, we'll send you some right away.
Do that. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on.
Sports gel's phenomenal.
No, pleasure. So what a cool life you've had, man. I mean, Jesus Christ, Paul Newman's your godfather. It just says it up.
Yeah, Stan thank Barrett. You very much.
OJIEnergetics.com. You can find them. I will talk about this because I've got a big jar in front of me that I'm going to start dosing with after the show and on a daily basis from now on, because I could use every edge I could get. Thanks so much. Stock car driver, stuntman extraordinaire, 200 films under his belt, obviously an entrepreneur. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be here.
Take
Thank
care.
You very
Enjoy
much.
New York. Welcome to Bushwick.
Great
And if
place.
You want, grab a pizza on the way. It's too cool. The pizza here is great. You can't come here really without having a
Got
pizza.
It. This is a cool place.
It's a cool place, and the pizzas are slamming. Like, you'll have this pizza and go, you'll think about this pizza like for months to come.
That's the problem.
That's the problem. But so you're here. Take advantage. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My next guest is going to be on for 1 second. Stay tuned. We're going to play some music. And then Alice Loubaton is coming on. He's going to talk about French cheese and wine. Stay tuned for that after this.
Dead of night.
Hey, welcome back. Food Talk. Michael Lomeco here. Glad that was fun, too. This is just too fast a show today. It's great to have Stanton Barrett in here. What a cool guy. Paul Newman as your godfather. God damn, is it any better than that? Holy shit. All right, enough of that. Alice Louboutin's in the house, and this is what I have about shoes. There's a famous shoe, Louboutin, something like it almost spells like that. Alice and I share one thing in common, sort of, in a weird way. Alice, at one point in her life, graduated from Bryn Mawr College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania.
Yes, I did.
And when I was in high school, during part of my misspent youth. Actually, my whole youth was misspent. Most of my life, I think, has been. But at one point, one of my jobs was I was a cook in the dormitories for Bryn Mawr College.
Which dorm?
Don't ask me, man. That was like, it was like 1971 or two. And I just remember like working in Bryn Mawr College thinking like, what are these, all these smart kids, man? This is something. So let's talk first and foremost, Alice. Cheese
yes.
Week in New York. Talk about it. How is this like the first ever? Is it the 10th and I missed the last 9?
No, it is the first in New York.
Ooh, I feel good about that. Okay.
Yes.
That's good.
Last year in Paris was the very first Cheese Day. And it was a great success. They actually had to turn people away.
Wait a minute. In Paris, they had a cheese day? I thought like every day was cheese day in Paris.
Well, you
what
would think
hell?
So. In any case, they decided to put the spotlight on cheese and fine wine and spirits and so forth. And obviously, there was a need for it, even among the French, because it was a great success. And so the gentleman who had started Cheese Day Paris said, wow, we should really take this to other cities. And of course, he chose New York first. Knowing that New York yes. is so much bigger, it couldn't be a day. It had to be a week.
Okay.
So it became Cheese Week.
And who's participating and how? Are there restaurants? Are there chefs? Are there retailers?
A little of all. You've got most of the maître cuisinier de France. That is...
I know who they are, but
you know
the kids
who they
today
are.
Don't want that.
Right.
Man,
these are chefs who are either cooking in the French tradition
yes.
or are French themselves and
yes.
are based in New York. Some of them very famous restaurants that you would know. Let's name one, Daniel Boulud. Who's probably the most famous of the group. And there are other very, very fine master chefs in the group. And they have a chapter of the Maître Cuisinier de France here in the United States, in New York. And they have agreed to feature cheeses and cheese-based dishes next week from February 21st to 26th in their restaurants.
What if I walked into Marie's Cheese on Bleecker Street? Would I notice a display? Would I see
okay.
something different?
So
and
Murray's.
It's not just Murray's, because Murray's is also now Kroger, basically. It's like kind of one big animal. But it's okay. I mean, Rob got paid. Whatever. It happens.
Okay.
That's the way it goes.
So Murray's Cheese is doing several things. Every day next week, there will be demos from 3 to 6 p.m.
Upstairs in that demo space.
Right. And then there will be nightly pairing specials at Murray's Cheese Bar, because you know Murray's Cheese.
Next door.
A few doors down yeah. is Murray's Cheese Bar. So there will be French cheese and wine pairings in addition to the regular menu. Not only that, Stéphane Candler, who is the owner and winemaker at Chateau Touril, of the Languedoc,
yes.
Is one of the sponsors, of the wine sponsors of Cheese Week, and he is actually going to be present next week in New York, and he will be there at Murray's Cheese Bar on Thursday the 23rd from 5 to 7 p.m. So he will be pouring the wine for that special cheese and wine flight.
And isn't there, I had somebody on here a little while ago, it's kind of like, I thought it was a pop-up, but it isn't. There's like a new French There's a cheese store on like
Spring Street.
Spring Street called
41 Spring Street, to be exact.
It's really cute. It's in that section of Nolita, yes. Just north of Little Italy.
And it's between Mott and Mulberry.
Between Mott and Mulberry on the north side, mid block, and it's really kind of a cool space.
And it's very cute, and the name is cute because it's called the French Cheese Board, which is a play on words because the organization in France that sponsors it is the French Cheese Board. The official trade board. Gotcha. So it's very cute. It's a beautiful space.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's right.
I think people should really go in and discover it because you can buy cheese there. You can taste cheese there. You can learn about cheese and cheese making. It's very cool.
Yeah, and it's not like cluttered. It's not like you're walking in and there's aisles of cheese.
No.
They were only selling like six or seven varieties of cheese.
It's very curated.
They bore down very deeply.
Yes.
And then there's like people there are super. What did you bring? You bought a ton of cheese.
Speaking of Murray's, I was there just a few hours ago.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, the guy behind the counter, when I said, oh, well, you know, I need this for a wine and cheese tasting that I'm doing with a radio talk host. He said to me, it's not wine and cheese, madam. It's cheese and wine.
Okay.
And I said, okay, we're in Murray's. Right. And so he gave me this wonderful assortment. We consulted, and I think that the cheeses are, and he said, do not put these in the refrigerator.
Of course.
Most people don't realize
the temperature they're supposed to eat cheese. Yeah.
Cheese should never be in the refrigerator just before serving. You should probably take it out at least an hour or two before.
Easily.
And that's something that most people don't know. And I tell them the cold actually paralyzes the cheese and makes it numb.
Yeah, and you can't taste things when they're cold anyway. I mean,
it's the same thing with a white wine that's been over-chilled.
Yeah, people drink wine out of the refrigerator. 42
and it's
degrees
numb.
And it's shut
numb.
Down.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So anyway, we have here some, in honor of Cheese Week, we have some beautiful cheeses from France. We have a Picot. This is a Picot Picadine, and it's from the Poitou.
Yeah, I know how to spell. I know that. Yes. Poitou. It's one of those weird words.
It's a goat
That's
cheese.
That's this guy. It's a goat
yes,
cheese.
Yes, it is a goat cheese. So we have goat's milk cheese here. We have sheep's milk cheese. And we have cow's milk cheese. I wanted to cover sort of, as they say, France is a grand plateau de fromage. France itself is a great cheese tray.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Churchill had that great line that, you know, country that has 350 cheese for every day of the year.
I think it's more like 400 and something.
I'm
now.
Sure it is.
There's some
I'm
new
sure
appellations. So we have these wonderful cheeses here. And what I wanted to talk about, because we have, why is it cheese and wine or wine and cheese? And most people don't, they say, yes, it's wonderful. I want to do a wine and cheese tasting. Wine and cheese go great together. But do they know why? And it's the old idea, I tell people, of why do the English put milk in their tea? Because tea has tannin in it, right? Sometimes you can drink a tea if you've let the bag steep too long. That makes your mouth pucker.
Right.
Those are tannins.
Right.
Okay, wine has tannin. Tannin is really the backbone. Otherwise, the wine would collapse. But people find sometimes that the tannins are a little bit astringent. Okay? And the cheese is protein. And protein and tannin, when they come together, I won't say they neutralize each other, but they come together in a perfect marriage that makes each one taste better.
Somebody was here a couple of weeks ago with some camembert, and we paired it with I usually drink white wine with cheese. I must say, in the interest of full disclosure, I really like white wine with cheese because I find when you talk about tannin and sometimes red wines are oaked, that those sort of oaky tannins fight with each other, with cheese anyway. But we're pouring wine here. So let's eat some cheese. Let's cut some cheese. You have all this cheese. We're just sitting here talking. I feel bad. Pamela Whitman's in the house, and she's got a knife and a cheese board, and we have bread, and it's not working. Don't worry about it. The thing's not working. It's broken. Don't worry. We have a little bit of wine in this glass. I'll live. So what am I drinking? Is this like a Marsan Roussan? I don't think there's any Viognier. Yeah, what is this? Do we know what this is?
The are you talking about the white or the
Roussan? Only one I have.
The white.
Yeah.
Oh, the rosé.
This is the rosé?
So,
it is. Look at that color. Barely. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. You know what we can do? We can open. I was using the Coravin, but we seem to be having a technical problem. I do have a corkscrew, if you'd like to open the bottle the regular way.
My fingers.
This, the rosé, is actually a blend. And the rosé is called Havana. This is from Chateau Touril in the Languedoc. This is AOC Minervois. It's 70% Cinsault and 30% Grenache.
Right.
And why is it called Havana?
I don't know.
Because Stefan, the winemaker and owner, he loves Cuba and he loves cigars. And so he gave that name to this wine, which he also loves.
Got you. Me too. I've never been to Cuba, but I love cigars.
Uh-huh. And so I think it's a really nice, nicely balanced wine, and I think it goes really well, probably really well with the goat cheese.
That cheese was delicious. I just tasted it. I love this cheese. Okay. I've become like a cheese addict. I don't know when this happened. Why I turned like 59 to 60, and so now I eat cheese like almost every night after dinner because I'm not a dessert guy. And I found it's like a little like suddenly it became a habit because I don't eat much during the day, so I have a pretty decent dinner, but I don't eat that much dinner. And then I get the munchies at like 8 o'clock at night, so I take cheese out when I'm making dinner and I let it sit at room temperature. And then at like 8:30, 9 o'clock when I'm hungry, I just eat some cheese.
And you
it just seems like – and it's almost like a daily thing that popped up out of nowhere at this age of my life.
Well,
why? I don't know.
Anyway, the dairy is very healthy.
Well, I'm not arguing.
Right?
I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
And
– also it's an excuse to have another glass of wine, which
right.
is true.
And, you know, I don't know who said it, but there's a wonderful expression, cheese is milk's leap into immortality.
I have heard that, and I thought that
yes.
was brilliant.
It
That's
is.
That's true.
It's a great line.
Because you think about
line.
It, I mean, that was like the nexus of why cheese. I mean, you got to milk cows twice a day. You can only drink so much milk, use so much butter.
Right.
And then cheese is like this brilliant creature. And pretty much every culture that has dairy has a cheese element to it.
Right.
But none as brilliant as the French in a way, but we're getting really good at America too. So what's the second cheese? Talk to me about this with this kind
so
of
So the second
older,
one is
a little
it,
bit more
this
of a
is a
rind.
Sheep's milk from the Pyrenees. And it's been aged in a cave.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is Pyrenees Brebis, sheep's milk cheese from the Pyrenees, and it's made in the Basque country.
That's delicious.
In the Béarn region of the French Pyrenees Mountains. It's a pasteurized cheese, and it's really lovely.
So back to Cheese Week.
Yes,
we're going to see restaurants participating. They'll be doing something at Danielle. Is there like a website people can go to avail themselves of all of the
yes
permutations? There may be a tasting. Like we know that Murray's is doing something every day, but
yes, so. Let's go back to the French Cheese Board that you mentioned.
Okay.
The French Cheese Board is having something that people can take advantage of next week, and this is for the public. There will be free cheese and wine pairing tastings on the 24th, 25th, and 26th of February, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday from 5 p.m. to 7 Saturday from 4 to 6, and Sunday from 4 to 6, and it's complimentary. There's no cost, but you must reserve in advance, and I will give you the email to write to.
Give me the email to write to.
Cheeses of France, all in one word, at thebaddishgroup.com.
Holy shit, that's
the Baddish, B-A-D-D-I-S-H.
You know what we'll do? You leave that with our esteemed engineer, and he will stick it on the website. No one's going to remember that.
Okay. So cheeses of France at thebaddishgroup.com.
Gotcha. It'll be on the website.
It'll be on the website, and everyone can register, reserve free of charge Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
And it's supposed to be a great weekend. It's supposed to be warm this weekend, right? It's supposed to, like, today's freezing.
Well, it's not this weekend. It's the following
next weekend. Okay, well, maybe it'll be warm then, too. If not, you can eat cheese when it's cold. Doesn't matter.
Okay, another thing, Zabar's, if you're
uptown,
on the Upper West Side, Zabar's will be doing in-store tastings, cheese samplings on February 24th and 25th from 2 to 5 p.m. The Maison Kaiser chain, which
Love
I'm sure
Eric
you
Kaiser.
Know, right?
Love Eric Kaiser.
Maison Kaiser is going to be highlighting all of their French cheese-based dishes and French cheeses next week, such as French onion soup, croque monsieur, a cheese platter.
I tell you what, if you've never been, here's an excuse, folks. We're going to have to wrap this segment up in a minute. But if you've never been to Maison Kaiser in New York, go. They're all over the place. Eric Kaiser started in Paris, I don't know, 20-some years ago. He's a master baker. He's Alsatian. He's a beast. His breads are so good. He now has over 100 Maison Kaisers around the world.
Yes.
And in New York, he's expanded. He's got 6 or 7 of them. I remember when he first opened up on the Upper East Side. Now he's down. He's got 2 in Flatiron, 1 by Union Square. To my mind, it is probably the best baguette in the city. And his other baked goods are amazing. And the savory stuff is really strong, too. So that's a great excuse to hit Maison Kaiser, buy some great bread, get some pastry to go, and some cheese-based recipes.
And if I might... Yeah. Stefan, as I told you, Stefan Candler of Chateau Touril will be here. And on Monday, February 27th at 7:30 p.m., he's doing a special winemaker dinner at Madison Bistro at 238 Madison Avenue. And it is a special four-course meal, which will be created by Chef Claude Godard, who is one of the maître cuisiniers de France. And if people want to reserve, it's $75 a person, four wines that are going to be poured by Stefan himself, and four delicious courses. The telephone number to reserve is...
We'll have it on the website. We'll put it on the website. We're going to leave that whole piece of paper that you're holding and reading from with my guy, and he's going to give us a link so that we can... Because that's going to be... All that stuff's on the website. Bingo. We'll just go to the website, folks. Celebrate cheese. You know, I have become a complete cheesehead. Tia Keen was here a few weeks ago. I love Tia Keen and Aristo. She has a great new book out, The Art of the Cheese Plate. You know Tia? She's great. She opened, when Murray's opened up his cheese bar, she was like the original fromager. Murray kind of picked her. She started Kozalulu. She's a genius. Thanks so much for coming out.
You're welcome. We've chewed up
20 minutes too quickly. Thanks for bringing cheese. Thanks for bringing wine. Folks, eat cheese more often. It's great for you. I can attest to that. It's so much fun. And
thank you,
like,
Mike.
I'm not a dessert
guy,
so it's like after dinner. Cheese, anytime. That's always what I opt for. You can have the chocolate thing over there or that spring, but no, I want cheese.
The Big Apple next week is going to be the big cheese.
The big cheese. Thank you. That's a great way to finish. The Big Apple is going to be the big cheese. Eat cheese, live longer. It's true. Stay tuned. My last guest is amazing. This kid's 25 years old. He is one of the truffle kings of America. Started a business at 17. He's from the middle of nowhere. He came to New York and got into the truffle business. And guess what? He's like an expert on ingredients, truffles specifically, but other things we're going to talk about. Truffles a lot, but also ingredients, ingredient fraud, and how a kid like him developed this business basically out of thin air in the space of just a couple of years. He became like a guy that nobody knew to a guy that everyone wants his truffles. Stay tuned for that next, right after this break. Folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavita's living in Rome, Colavita's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. Folks, welcome back. Welcome back. I've got a book in front of me. We had it on my desk just the other day. Love the blurb for it. It's called Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. Ian, pronounce your last name for me.
It's Perkiasta.
I'm glad I didn't do that because I would have never gotten that. So this is a crazy, crazy story. Talk to me. I mean, you got blurbs from everybody big. You got Sean Brock on the cover. You got David Chang doing an intro. I mean, wow, that's like, you know, young gun royalty. Let's kind of start. You're from where originally? Because I don't want to say like the middle of nowhere. Where are you from?
Well, I'm from Houston.
Okay, from Houston.
Yeah, but my family relocated to Arkansas.
When I was 16. So it kind of the middle of nowhere. Sorry about it.
No, don't even worry.
But your grandparents were like this huge influence. They had a cabin in the Ozarks.
They did.
And what was the nexus? What happened there that got you into food?
Well, I had always like grown up eating well and cooking with my grandfather and my mother, and we relocated to Arkansas when I was 15 because my grandparents had built this cabin in the Ozarks in the 80s, and we would visit as kids. And, you know, during the recession, my family just decided that it was time to change. And so Arkansas was this pursuit at a simpler life. And so we got to Arkansas. And, of course, it was very difficult adjusting and making friends. And so I started spending a lot of time with my uncle and his family, who were already living in Arkansas. And my uncle was an avid outdoorsman and loved the outdoors. And, you know, he took me mushroom foraging. And so that's how I got hooked on all things mushrooms and how I became obsessed with foraging almost 10 years ago. And so that kind of propelled me on this journey to discovering all these different varieties of mushrooms. And
Mushrooms are above ground, and now we got truffles, which is kind of a related species.
Truffles are related. They're an underground fungus that have a symbiotic
relationship with the things that are certain
with their host tree.
Host tree.
So they grow on the roots of trees, and so there are no local truffles in Arkansas. But what ended up happening was that I'd always wanted to taste truffles because truffles are considered the king of the castle with mushrooms. And so on a visiting trip to Houston, I went to visit some friends, and they graciously invited me out to dinner. And they said, you know, Ian, order anything on the menu. And I saw this black truffle ravioli dish with the foie gras sauce. And I was like,
Holy shit.
I really need to have this. And so I ordered it. And from that moment on, I mean, from the moment the truffle touched my lips, I mean, it was pure ecstasy.
So how was the truffle incorporated in the dish? Was it in the filet of the ravioli? Was it shaved?
Black
truffles are normally cooked.
Yes, yeah, so it was chopped in the ravioli, and then there was also some in the sauce, and there was obviously some slices as well on top of the ravioli.
And so you have this flavor. We're not going to bother. I mean, most of us are listening to this. You're a foodie. You've tried. So white truffles are really super pungent, very different. Usually eat them raw. Black truffles are cooked. Those are kind of the ones I grew up eating more of because I worked in French kitchens. But it's really hard to describe the flavor profile, so I'm not going to get into it because it's like
it's just subjective.
It's really subjective, but it's really unctuous, really rich, full of umami, fucking delicious.
Right.
So we're gonna kind of fast forward because I love the book because it starts like at the beginning. So you forego college,
right? So I
decide your dad was an entrepreneur, so he was supportive. You had an idea, Dad, I want to do this thing. And your dad said, okay, so with like a little loan of a few thousand dollars, $4,000 or $5,000.
No loan. No.
You come to New York and you're living in Weehawken and you're working for who?
So I'm working for an Italian company.
Right.
So my senior year of high school, I'm basically cold calling different accounts and I find this Italian company that's looking for U.S. representation. And so
it was not Urbani. It was somebody else.
Yes.
Yes.
And it was
letting you know that.
Yes.
And they're big players.
They are.
We'll get into them later.
And so they were looking for someone in the U.S. to bring in truffles and find customers for them. And so I.
You're right. So you're like a 17-year-old kid. I'll do it.
Yeah, basically. So
a 17-year-old kid from Arkansas. I'll do it.
Well, yeah. So senior year, I was basically bringing in shipments for them and finding customers and shipping truffles out of state to different cities across the U.S. And I turned my parents' garage into a shipping center. And after class, I would, you know, make sales calls or, you know, after school, I would go to the airport and pick up truffle shipments. And
what airport is there in
Northwest Regional Arkansas? Yeah, Northwest Arkansas.
Sorry, I have not had the pleasure of entering or exiting that airport.
So with the profits that they had made my senior year, they established an office, a small office for me in Newark, New Jersey. And so,
which
after,
is, if you've never been to Newark, folks, it's charm.
It's very, very delightful.
Tidy little picket fences and Victorian houses and green lawns and neighbors that wave to each other from front
people
porches.
People are just so nice.
Yeah.
And so I moved and I told my parents, you know, this is something that I really want to do. And, you know, I think I'm so fortunate to have parents that allowed me to like move to New York with no job and no, well, I guess I had this job, but I mean, no plans for college. I mean, of course, they wanted.
And you're also, are your parents first generation or second generation?
My father's Indian. So yeah, he moved.
And I don't want to make generalizations, but I mean, a lot of times, you know, Indian parents, like Korean parents, sure, like dude, college,
well that was
postgraduate shit. You're going to be one of three things.
Well, that was something that my parents had always established early on. But I think that, you know, once I started selling these truffles in high school and they realized that this could be something interesting, they let me defer college and move to New York and, you know, kind of go my own way. And it was
say move to New York, we're going to have to put an asterisk on that because
New Jersey.
Thank you. And I hate to shit on Jersey. I got a house in Cape May. Whatevs, folks. But the difference between living on this side of the Hudson and that side of the Hudson,
it's a huge difference.
It's market. It's only separated by a couple hundred yards of the Hudson River. But culturally speaking, it may as well be. Well, take that New Yorker cartoon, actually, sort of. But anyway, we won't get into that. It's an old cartoon. So your first apartment was this like Verstunken third floor walk up in some shithole building where the guy smokes cigarettes.
Basically. I mean, you know, it was a nice family, but yeah, I mean, I was living
in the book.
I was living in the attic apartment and, you know, I knew nobody and had, no money and no friends. And it was bleak for the next
didn't know anybody
years.
Here. And so I mean, you got balls, brother. So I'm reading the book and I get to like in the beginning of the book. So you're in a crappy apartment, and you're gazing across the Hudson longingly at Gotham City.
Well, my street actually overlooked the Manhattan skyline. I mean, it was beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
And every night I would be like, wow, it's so pretty.
Be nice to
One day, maybe I'll go.
And then, like, your first calls are, like, cold calls, and you're not just – I mean, you're walking
– So the very first
day – It's not easy to get into, per se. It's not easy to get into that kitchen. You're up in the Time Warner building.
Sure. I mean, it was hellish. I mean, the very first day I cold called, I had a little rolling bag filled with truffles, and my very first cold call was per se.
Right, where basically you're lucky you didn't just get thrown out the window.
Well, I mean, they are basically like, you know, who the fuck are you?
Right.
And they didn't buy anything, but...
Who was the chef then? Benno?
No, he had just left.
Okay.
It was still Eli.
Okay.
And then my second stop was Le Bernardin.
Okay.
Same story.
Have fun just down the street, just down the street.
Third stop was Danielle.
Okay.
Yeah, right? I'm hitting all those uptown restaurants.
Yeah.
And then I go downtown. I go to Momofuku. Same story. I go all the way to Brooklyn Fair. Same story. And then I make a couple more calls. And, you know, I had spent $50 on cab rides. And to me at the time, that was just so much money.
Yeah.
And so I left defeated. You know, I took the train from Port Authority back to my my warehouse in Newark, and I fell asleep, and I you know, got into this daze, and I woke up right at my warehouse, and so I hopped off the bus and started walking to my warehouse with this bag full of truffles, and that's when I got jumped.
So if you didn't think his day was bad enough, so his first day, folks, first day, welcome to Gotham City. Per se, no thanks. Repair, Bernardin, no thanks. Daniel, no thanks. Mofuku, no thanks. Brooklyn Fair, no thanks. Falls asleep on the bus from the Port Authority. And if you've ever been to the Port Authority, that's depressing, too. Then you get one of those shit buses on the way to Newark.
Sure.
Wake up. You're walking back to the...
Well, my warehouse was actually... it was above a methadone clinic. So my parents had actually advised me to skip that direct stop in
take
front
the next
of...
Stop. Yes,
take the next stop. Yes. And that was the wrong choice, obviously.
So you're walking with your briefcase full of thousands of dollars of truffles, and suddenly you notice... that there's four or five kids on BMX bicycles circling around you. You're not from the city. So instead of having your little radar go off like, shit's going to happen, I better start it or something, you find yourself like suddenly knocked on the ground with kids grabbing your cell phone, your wallet, and your bloody truffles.
Dumping the truffles into the street.
Rolling around on the streets of Newark.
Yeah, it was pretty bleak. Cars are going by. I mean,
running over the truffles.
I mean, they're being turned into pate on the cement.
So this is like the worst moment of your life. So let's when did things start to turn the corner? Let's go like like 40 pages into the book. So at some point you get some
three years down the
that long.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It took a while. I mean, honestly, you know, I was paid on commission only. So every sale I made was, you know, 5% in my pocket. And it got to the point where the Italians were like, you know what? You're making too much money for a 19, 20 year old. And
fuck you. We'll do it ourselves.
Well, I mean, it was kind of like an insult because it's like, I am living this really depressing life.
And you built a business for them.
I've built this company, right. And yet I have no money, and I like can't afford to go out to any of the restaurants I'm selling to. So that's when I realized something has to change. And so for the next 8 months, I started, you know, devising a way of getting out of there, and eventually I did. And I started my own company, and now it's almost 5 years old. And
you're selling everybody?
Yes. We sell to...
all the places we're just talking about. For the most part.
For the most part. There's like one on that list that I won't mention. That I don't really get along
with. So let's get into truffle, because one of the things that's fascinating to me, you're so young, you're so smart, you're so stoked, you must have thick skin to put up with... I mean, I 3 years is a long time to be... So then again, everyone who comes to New York, shit, my first 3 years in New York, I think I moved five fucking times, man.
Right,
it was like,
right.
Whatever. You realize, this place doesn't like, you know, it's not welcoming you with open arms.
Oh,
you want to come here, you got to kick some ass to get noticed.
No, totally.
But the trouble business is full of like mislabeling and fraud and bullshit. So I'll flash back to when I was a kid at the CIA. So I'm like a broke kid from Philly. I'm at the Culinary Institute of America. It's 1980. And I'm trying to think how I can save money, make money. So I'm an RA in the dorms, so you get free room and board. And you get to meet the girls. But there weren't that many girls anyway. But I met my wife. So that worked. And so then I'm thinking, so I also knew about food distribution, and I knew some big New York importers. Why don't I go to the purchasing agent of the CIA and say, hey, you know, I'm old. I'm like 22-year-old guy that's been in the business. Why don't I sell you some stuff? So I do. The Italian guy is a Persian guy. I go there. I said, you know, I've got this catalog from a New York importer. I'd like to sell you some things. And I'm not going to sell cornmeal or flour because there's no money in that. So he says, sure, bring some. So I'm looking at saffron, dried morels, truffles. I'm just cherry picking the high-end shit.
Right.
So I have them send me samples. This is a crazy, you'll love this. I have them send me samples of their black truffles in tins.
Okay.
And the Culinary Institute was buying from Urbani at that point.
Okay.
So we open up our black truffles, and we're cutting. You know how you cut samples next to each other, you call it cutting. We're cutting these samples, and ours look great when you take them out of the can. But then when you go to cut them on the inside, they're really like light colored, like white.
Right.
And I'm like, what the fuck? And the morels looked just about like morels, but they were slightly different.
Huh.
So back then there's no internet. There's no like real fast check your smartphone, take a picture, da-da, you got. Back then you went to the library and you read like, what could this be?
Right.
Turns out that the truffles were summer truffles
that
were packed in a jar with black dye. And by the time they went through the retort and you opened that can a year later, they looked like a black truffle. They'd absorbed the dye, but they weren't black truffles.
Right.
So you're not selling apples for apples. Turns out the morels were false morels. There's a species of morel.
Sure.
It's poisonous, but there's a way to remove the toxicity.
If
they're blanched. But of course they're cheaper. So I'm like, what? Like that's my intro to like, and then now I've learned all about the bullshit of like the olive oil business, how, you know, tank farms in Italy or have shit coming in from all over the world comes in Italy, and now it's Bertolli Italian oil, or now it's Berio Italian or whatever.
Right.
Sorry, those brands, but you know the story. So talk about truffles, because it's crazy. And specifically, let's get to Serbia and the guy, because that's a really cool story.
Right.
Like Italy sells 99% more olive oil than it makes.
Sure.
Italy sells a hell of a lot more truffles than are being foraged by little guys with dogs in Alba.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think my hope with this book was to demystify a lot of these exotic ingredients and to really show like the origins of where these ingredients are actually coming from. And with truffles in particular, I mean, everyone thinks that white truffles come from Alba in Italy and black truffles come from Perigord in France.
Correct.
And in reality, I mean, the majority of white truffles are now coming from Eastern Europe. I mean, Serbia is a huge exporter of white truffles. And when I say exporter, I mean smuggled out of the country, because there's actually a huge 100% tax on Serbian truffles if you disclose them to the Serbian government. So Serbia,
and they're
Hungary,
the exact same. It's tuber stevium.
Tuber magnatum.
Tuber magnatum. It's the exact same truffle growing in Alba.
So yes,
quality wise, they're like, you cannot tell them apart.
Well, here's the thing with truffles. I like to say that truffles have their own terroir, like wine.
Okay.
So just because it's the same species doesn't mean it's going to taste exactly the same. But white truffles from northern Italy and Piemonte and from Tuscany and from the Marche have a very similar flavor and aroma to the white truffles in Serbia. However, white truffles in southern Italy, for instance, have a completely different aroma and flavor and are actually $500 a kilo less because of this slight change in odor and shelf life. Actually, they're very, very poor in shelf life, the white truffles from southern Italy. So
how's this disclosed? Like when I get, because I used to be, no, when Johnny Magazzino sends me an email every fall, and now the white truffles are coming in, and here's one the size of a tennis ball, and here's the price per kilo. And, or I'm at some restaurant, and the truffle lady shows up with her. Is she still in business?
Yes.
Some hot Italian chick that sells truffles and has little bags that say the truffle lady.
Yep.
Like, how do we know where that shit's coming from?
These are actually all characters in the book, actually. But
Sorry, everybody.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't
Are they identified as characters in the book, or are they under other names?
You know, aliases and
Okay,
such.
Okay, sorry.
I mean, so...
We're going to get to Urbani in a minute, because that's fascinating.
I don't want to say anything bad about the competition, but...
But I'm saying as a consumer, like... How do
nothing is disclosed. I mean,
nothing.
Truffles.
It's like a mystery thing.
It's a mystery box, and I think the reason why I've done well is that I have taken this educational role, and you know, chefs trust me. And
you
have
David Chang wrote you fucking open. And David said that like the people that he some of them, well, not that David doesn't like. David's not. David kind of hates like Agent Orange. It's like it's indiscriminate in a way. But he's smart because he's not just a hater. He just like the whole hype around specialty foods. 99% of it is bullshit. And I hate to say this to people, but a lot of the people involved in it are just bullshitters.
Sure.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's part of the book.
Totally.
It's part of the book. So you've gotten the chefs got you had to earn their trust by coming in that back door and explaining shit to them that they may not have known.
Sure, but it's also walking a fine line because it's like with some customers, you know, some chefs don't want to be taught anything new because they're in this position where they know everything there is to know about ingredients and like who the fuck are you to tell them different?
Most chefs.
And so yeah, I mean there are passages in the book that go into this and like you know, in my day-to-day business, I try to cater to you know, a younger generation of chefs because, in my opinion, this younger generation of chefs are more willing and more open to learn about these ingredients. A joke I have with my colleagues is that, you know, not to sell to anyone above 50th Street because anyone above 50th Street is either,
so funny.
You know, very old or
it's
has been there forever.
It's
and
zip
so,
code bias, dude.
Sure,
I mean,
sure,
I've lived downtown since like the last 20 some years and, you know, my friends that are opening restaurants are in Upper East Side, they're like, come on, I'm like, last time I work out every day at 50. I was in New York Athletic Club, and then I just head south. If I don't have to go north of 14th Street, I'm happy.
Right,
and I don't have to go north of 14th Street for much.
Right, no, but I mean,
so
it's,
you've built
it's
this amazing business. You got this great story, and you're so bloody smart because it's not just. I mean, we can go into other stuff. What's that? The Gucci mushroom? That's hysterical. So you had this story where your parents. You hear about this mushroom from my
uncle.
From your uncle. Yeah, the Himalayas, I think.
Yes. So
called Gucci. And you're thinking it's G-U-C-C-I. That's how it's spelled. Gucci, like the clothes.
Gucci,
it's an Italian brand. It's an Italian luxury brand.
Yes.
And it turns out that they are?
They're morels. They're morel mushrooms that grow in the Himalayas.
As winter turns to spring, as that snow thaws.
Exactly.
And then you have this thing where you're trying to figure out, you're emailing some professor, and you're trying to figure out, like, I'd like to see these things, but I know it's time sensitive. And you get this first email, and it's like, does that mean come next year? But there's still snow on the ground, dude.
Right. So basically, like, I started foraging for morels in Arkansas when I was 15.
Right.
And I had the opportunity to go to the Himalayas and forage these Gucci mushrooms, which are of course morels. And so, yeah, I mean, it was just this wild, it's been a wild journey. I mean, these 9 years that, I've been in this industry and I've learned a whole lot and I've made a ton of mistakes, but,
that's how you learn.
It's been, I mean, everything has been, trial and error. And
did you ever meet Eugenia Bone? She was the head of the New York in Mike. What's that mushroom picking society?
The one in Tribeca?
Yeah, I think she's in Tribeca, Soho.
Yeah, she's
brilliant. So there's foragers in New York that go in the secret spots in Jersey and upstate. I mean, they know where to get stuff. We did. I mean, who knew? But it turns out in America, we have seps growing, we have morels growing, we have chanterelles growing.
We've got it all.
Right, didn't you? Isn't there a thing in your book about people picking up chanterelles in Central Park?
I've done it.
What the fuck? Where? I can't ask where. Then you'd blow the whole thing.
Well, you know.
Don't tell me where. I don't want to know where.
A dog probably pissed on the patch, but I mean.
yeah, right.
But
yeah,
or a rat or something. But there are tons of wild mushrooms and grains that grow within the city. I mean, I see Lamb's Quarter all the time growing in Bushwick.
Man, Chinese are so cool this way. I have seen Chinese women harvesting something in that median strip on Houston Street, like on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, ginkgo nuts.
It wasn't ginkgo nuts. It was an herb. They were all picking it. I'm like, what the fuck are they picking? But they knew what it was. And
right.
It's like, you know, they're smart. And it's free. And I'll just go home.
Maybe sassafras.
I go. It's going to go home. They're going to eat this shit. So I have to tell you, the Urbani thing was funny. I met Mrs. Urbani. I was in Umbria. We were filming. I was eating a restaurant. Some crazy restaurant. Some crazy guy in his. I loved half of his family. I didn't like him. And I'm sitting outside having a cigar after dinner, and this woman comes up and introduces herself as the Urbani. She lives upstairs. And you have this moment where you're watching 60 Minutes.
She lives upstairs here?
No, lives upstairs above this restaurant.
Okay.
With the tan, the one with the tan.
The tan, yes.
Enough said. So you have this 60 Minutes thing where you're watching 60 Minutes, and you're just like, with Leslie Stahl, and you're going, holy shit. Because, and I mean, the Urbanis are huge. They're kind of like royalty, whatever, so I'm not going to, if I say anything more, I'll probably die. Because
I cannot disclose anything.
But read the book. We'll just say read the book.
Read the book.
It's page something or other, and it's really, really funny.
Totally.
Well, congratulations, man. So this is a great read because, I mean, I have been championing. So I'm one of those old guys, and so many chefs of my generation, like, you know, bemoan the state of restaurants today and kids today. And I'm like, what the fuck? Do you ever get out of your bubble? Like, it's never been better. Like, the chefs in America are better than ever. The food scene is 1,000 times better than when I was a chef. The ingredients are it's a million times better. And the fact that you got, like, 25 and 30-year-olds going out to eat on a regular basis that can, like, read wine lists and talk about carbonic maceration and native. I mean, that's great. There's, like, a new species of young foodie.
Right.
And you're kind of like one of those guys that's, like, you're bringing this march forward, like, raising that consciousness.
Right.
Like, I'm a bird watcher, right? Kind of like not a good one, but I live in Cayman, so that's like one of the greatest birds. And it's like, I would like, when I make these young psalms, I meet these psalms when I'm in Paris and I'm in New York, and I'm like, what? You're 25 years old. How do you know this much about wine? Because they started studying at 15, 16, 17.
Right.
They got really good palates. They got really good brains. They're actually still having neural connections that are made, unlike me. And you're like one of those guys. You're just like this smart kid bringing it forward. The book's about that. It's about your coming of age story from getting mugged in Newark to living now in a 5,000 square foot loft in Tribeca. He came here in a Bentley. I know that for a fact. There's a Maybach or the Bentley park outside. Yeah, that's a fact.
Right, right.
No, congratulations on your success. It's a great book. Truffle
Thank
Boy's
you.
Name of the book. Pronounce your last name, Ian.
Prakayastha.
Truffle Boy. We have a link to the website. It's a really, really great read. And I love it
so
also
much.
Because I think it shines a light on how much fraud there is in this business. And part of the problem is like the USDA, like our labeling laws, they're just so bad. I was in the import business and like, don't even ask.
Or they're just non-existent.
It basically, they're as porous as anything has ever been. It's crazy. Thanks for coming on. Continued success. And thanks for the truffles. He brought me some truffles.
Some black winter from Spain.
Yeah, and that was the other thing, too. Like the book you're talking about, like, right. Because this
Spanish
is
black truffles,
we keep thinking, like, all those years, it was like French, Burgundy, you know, Perigord, Burgundy. And
it's all bullshit.
Yes.
They all come from other places.
So these are Melanosporum?
These are.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, we got to wrap it up. We've gone a little over an hour. Fun show. Thanks. I really liked your interview. It was great. Thanks so much for coming on. Continued success with the book.
Thank you.
And your career.
Thank you so much.
Well, all right, stay tuned for Food Talk. Next week, I've got Pascaline Lepeltier, master sommelier, and Andy Bennett. She's one of the co-owners and the woman who runs the wire program at Rouge Tomat. Andy's a chef. We're going to talk to them the whole hour about what it was like to open in New York last year after a two-year delay. Love these people. Love Pascaline. If you like wine, stay tuned next week.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.